Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We are here to talk about I keep calling it the Unbreakable Trilogy, but it's referred to as the Glass Trilogy.
I felt like, right? I started calling it the Glass Trilogy, but I didn't know if that was actually what Shyamalan approved.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever. So we're talking about... I'll just say all the movies. Talking about... nope, that's next time. Unbreakable.
Split. And then Glass.
And then Glass.
Yeah.
So those three movies are all in the same universe.
They indeed are.
Yeah. Many years apart.
Thrilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. But even more thrilling than that is what's new with Meredith?
Just like wrapping up the end of the school year. I can't believe there's like 12 days of school left or something.
Yeah, we've got 3 weeks, but the last week is like, it's nothing. We can't assign work. We can't evaluate anything. It's just, we're just holding pens for students.
Everyone's working on their fine motor.
Yeah. Everybody clean stuff.
So we're planning our honeymoon and we've booked all of the stuff that we're doing.
It's pretty epic. Things.
I'll read it.
Please.
I'll read you what we're doing.
I would love to hear what you guys are doing on your honeymoon I could live vicariously through it.
I sent it to Rachel, and then she's like, whoa, that's a lot.
So she will not be doing something similar for her own honeymoon.
She goes,
no, I don't know. That's too much.
There's too many people. Okay.
Well, are you ready? That's the world. There's people in the world.
I know. Flying to Rome, day zero. Stay the night in Rome, and then the next morning go to Sorrento and go spend the day at a private beach.
Like, private, like, just you and Victor?
Well, it's, like, couples.
There's, like, no other, like, ladies with their tits out?
Probably so, but whatever. that's their business. So then...
it's not part of my honeymoon. Yeah.
Then day two, Pompeii. We're going to go see where and Victor wrote this. We're going to check out where a ton of people got murdered by the earth. That's my husband. Okay. Day three, sunset boat ride along the Amalfi Coast. Day four, train to Florence. We're just drinking in Florence. Sounds great. Uffizi Museum, day five. We get to see all the Michelangelo paintings. And then the Accademia, where we can see the Statue of David. Day six, Tuscany, where we see more food and wine. My husband just came in.
It's like you summoned him with the description.
He's going to
of
use the
your
toilet.
Yep. Oh, just kidding.
Okay.
It was not a romantic summoning.
Yeah. Day 7 and 8, which is chilling in Florence and eating. Train from Florence to Lake Como.
Mm-hmm.
On day 9.
To meet George Clooney.
Yeah, we're good friends. As one does. Everyone. I have a famous podcast. Of course, we're good friends. Okay. 10 and 12, hang out at Lake Como and take boat trips and eat more food. I think we're just like eating.
We're just pretty much eating everything that
they
have.
For 3 weeks. Day 10 and 12, yeah, we're hanging around Lake Como. Day 13, we're going to Brussels. And then we're going to Bruges and we're hanging out in Bruges and then going to a chocolate museum. And then we're seeing we're going to visit his family in Charleroi because when they immigrated, some came to the United States from Sicily, and some came to Brussels from Sicily. And then we're going to Rome from there, and then we'll hang out in Rome and go to the Vatican, see some Catholic stuff. We'll go see the Roman Colosseum, see where lions ate people. And it'll be great, and then we'll fly home.
Nice.
Sounds fantastic.
So that's like an epic journey. I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, when we did our honeymoon, we also went to Italy, but we went to Florence, and our whole attitude toward it was that, like, no, we don't want to try and see everything. We want to, you know, just embrace one area. And so we went to Florence, and we did day trips to Siena
and Pisa.
And Pisa. But other than that, we spent the entirety of our honeymoon in Florence. And so, you know, we did the Uffizi and we, you know, did the Palazzo d'Accademia, which is where David is. And of course, I was like being the rule follower. I was like walking into the, you know, seeing the David where you're not permitted to take photos of the David. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm
Wait, why are you not allowed to?
It's the rule.
No, everyone
you're not,
says
you're
that?
Not allowed to photograph him. Everybody fucking does, but I walked in like, well, that's the rule, so I'm going to follow the rule, and I, like, wanted to slap across the face all the people taking photos of the statue, but yeah, no, that is the...
Is that true? We're not allowed to take pictures of David?
Yeah, that's the policy of the museum, is that you're not allowed to photograph the David.
I have one, from when I went last time.
So he's a fucking rule breaker, too.
Yep.
He's
typical.
Like that doll.
What doll?
Oh, Robert the doll that curses you when you take pictures of him and you don't get permission.
What doll is that from?
It's in Key West. And he's like a creepy urban legend doll.
Okay.
And you go and visit him and he belonged to a person and then in the like early 1900s and now he belongs to a museum and he's in a glass case.
Yeah.
And you have to ask permission to take a photo of him, and mm-hmm. if you don't take a photo of him, like be respectful, I guess, and just mm-hmm. like see what happens, then people usually will have all these like bad luck
interesting
befall them, which I don't actually think is true, but there's like so many postcards and things all around him, mm-hmm. or at least at the museum, from people who wrote him, but like, I'm really sorry that I took a photo because it's like,
please
after
stop cursing my family.
Yeah, like after it's like they got a horrible car crash and then this happened and this happened and like all this crazy stuff happened, so who knows, but it could yeah. be like, you know, like planting the seed and then just all this stuff happens, who knows, but
yeah. Well, and a lot of that stuff, I mean, it's about them, you know, finding a way to monetize what they have to offer, yeah. because we also went to, so the church, the Catholic church that we were married in Burlingame was St. Catherine of Siena. And so while we were, one of the things that we did while we were honeymooning in Florence is we did take a day trip to Siena, and the church, the St. Catherine church in Siena has her relic, which is, you know, like Catholic, the whole Catholic thing with relics is it could be any body part, any portion of the human body that is remaining of the saint, the sanctified person, that would be part of their basilica or whatever. But for St. Catherine's, they have their whole fucking head. It's St. Catherine's mummified head is what is on display at the church in Siena in
Italy.
And
they wonder why there's so many horror movies like centered around Catholicism.
Right.
They're like, it's just bones and eyeballs.
It's bones. It's her entire head.
That's crazy.
And so when we went there and we did, I think we bought a postcard that had yeah. on it a
so
photograph.
So that's where they're like, okay, you can't get,
exactly.
you can take your own picture, but you can buy this.
You can buy our photo
but our
of it.
Professional photo.
Yeah. Because
a mug that's shaped like a skull.
With the little hand in it. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Which it really, when you're looking at the mummified head of a, you know, an ancient saint in a church in Italy, like, you know, who wants to be snapping a picture at that point? But
yeah.
But yeah, no, but that's the thing is I'm a rule follower. Like I would not have taken a picture of the David in that museum. And I would not have photographed the head of St. Catherine because the rule said you are not supposed to.
Well, I'm
so
married
I did
to
not.
A degenerate. What do you want from me?
And you, Victor.
So that's what's new with me. Everything's planned. We're very excited. And it's we're going June 8th. So we'll be out of here for 3 weeks.
I appreciate
weeks
you
a
waiting
day.
For after my birthday to go. That's very considerate of
When's
you.
When's your birthday?
The 7th.
Just like you planned it.
Just like you planned the whole
it.
Thing.
Wink, wink, wink. Victor's is the 2nd.
Yes.
Also.
June 2nd?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
That's his sister's birthday.
And my best friend's birthday. So
wait,
you your best friend with my sister?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, didn't you know?
Wow.
We're wow, BFF. This is a whole awkward coinciding.
What's your sister's name? We're best friends. Anyway, what's new with you?
Good question. I mean, same timeline with the approaching end of the school year. We've just got a couple weeks left and all of that bullshit is happening. Before we came down here, Tom and I popped in on the championship game for our 5th, 6th a baseball team. So it was ultimately it ended up only being two of my students in sixth grade and then a whole bunch of my fifth grade students on their baseball team. And it was like...
They're coming to you.
It's adorable. I mean, the quality of baseball being played in that moment is it's a beautiful thing because I really look at... The athletic program that exists among these schools is entirely for the students that are not necessarily athletically gifted, not necessarily athletically inclined to one sport over another. It's just for them to have the opportunity to get some exercise, learn some shit, play with their friends, get outside, and do all of that garbage. And it usually results in a really, really sad representation of whatever sport they're trying to produce.
That was all a very fancy...
It's just very bad news bears.
Yeah, it was a very fancy way of saying that they got mercied in the gym.
Yeah, they did. But to be fair, they were a... So when you have a combined physics team, then that means that they have to play up in the sixth division because it wouldn't be fair to have sixth graders playing against fifth graders. And but this team... Literally, it started out with 3 sixth graders on it, and then one of them dropped out because he's a, you know, super high caliber sixth grade baseball player, and he's like, this isn't worth my time. So it was an entire team of fifth grade boys and 2 sixth graders playing in the sixth grade league. So the fact that they made it the championship game alone, I mean, they only play like six games in the course of the season.
Four,
whatever. But yeah, it's just, it's nice to see, and especially baseball, because I mean, I have a really like sweet and positive association with the experience of playing baseball and watching baseball. For me, it's different from other sports for youth and for professional. But it was nice that we, you know, we went and uncomfortably sat out on a lawn and watched these like sweet little fifth grade boys
just
out there.
Just let all these balls roll by them.
Exactly.
On the
like
grass.
Flying over their heads.
And you're like, get your glove in the dirt. What are you doing?
They don't know where it's going. They don't know where they're supposed to be. But it was nice. So we did that this afternoon before we headed down here.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it was sweet. And like last night, I was back here down here in Pacifica for a playoff basketball game for the sixth grade girls in my class against St. Peter's, which is a Pacifica team. Mm-hmm. And you know, and they won that game, and it was a very exciting showdown. So you know, all of this end of the year stuff is fun.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. I'm a fan of, like, I don't know if you ever feel, like, pressured or obligated as a teacher to, like, you also have to show up to all this extracurricular bullshit. Do you feel like that?
No, I mean, we don't have stuff that's, like, sponsored by our school. So okay. It's, like, if I'm there, it's just because I happen to be there.
Yeah.
Like, if Deke's there at a game and I see my other students that I taught in the past, I might like wave at them or whatever, but I'm not like going there for them. I'm just like, oh, hi, I hope you do bad because you're playing against my son. No, I'm just joking. I'm like good luck, I hope you have a good day, you know, like I hope it's I hope you have fun. That's what I usually say.
Yeah, well, but
it's just sweet. Yeah, it's
Pacifica is a pretty small town where there's
it's very small.
You know, you can't show up to a youth sporting event and not see some people that you know.
Yeah, I usually do see. I'm like, oh, I might have your child next year for first grade. They're like, ooh, and, yeah, it's I didn't say that. I would never say that to a parent. Wink, wink.
I don't want to have your child at all.
I may or may not have your child.
I have no horse in that race.
I'm redacting all of what I just said. No, but it's fun, making those connections with the families. And they're really kind and supportive. And usually we just like go and hang out and we watch them. And we're like, yeah, do your best. But some families are really obnoxious. Not on my team, but like on other teams I've seen. A lot of really toxic fandom, I call it, or where you think your child's going to be like the next Clayton Kershaw or whatever. And it's like, you know, it's so over the top.
Like some perspective here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So well, that's what
that's the only part that makes me, gives me the ick where I'm like, ugh, that makes me cringe.
Part of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for the most part, everyone on our team has been, I mean, overall, actually, pretty good about it.
The game that I went to at St. Peter initially was going to have an attendance limit where it could only be 4 spectators per player. And it was because there was an earlier game in this grade level in CYO where they had to clear the gym after a game because a physical fight broke out in the stands amongst parents.
That's so ridiculous.
At a sixth grade girls basketball game.
No. I mean, the only time I get upset is if I feel like the ump isn't doing their job regarding safety.
Yeah. And then she goes and fucking punches them in the face.
I'm like, I will punch
and then
you.
Problem solved.
Send you right back to seventh grade. I'll punch you in the mouth. No, that's the only part where I'm like, you know, come on.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say anything, but yeah, that's the only part where I get like annoyed because I'm like, how come they're allowed to like do that? Because that's so unsafe. And anyway, but not necessarily like that's a bad call. I'm like, make bad calls. That's just what happens, right?
Just you know, what are you gonna do? Try and maintain the environment that we all want for this, you know, youth sports experience.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that's crazy. I'm not very, I know this is surprising. I'm not very social when it comes to going to like sporting events. And
you're
the other
not
team
also
moms
super
stuff.
Into sports.
No. But I've slowly like, I'm kind of an introvert by nature. So, but I've, you know, chatted up a little bit the different parents and it's nice, you know, to get to know people, whatever, but I have a hard time connecting with people. I always feel
like
awkward.
Do you listen to my podcast?
I'm like to the side. I'm like, what do you think about murder? And I'm kidding. I don't say that. I'm like, I hope the boys do well. And I'm like, well, see you later. You
know, like pip and cheerio.
I feel very like on the Dumb and Dumber scene.
Yeah.
Like I'm Lloyd, where I'm like, huh, big gulps, huh?
Big gulps, huh? Well,
see you later.
See like, you later.
That's me. That's like, that and lives, it,
you know,
that lives
in Pacifica,
rent-free in my head.
Like the big gulps line, that is 100% valid.
Yeah. So that lives rent-free in my head on how my interactions are with other adult people.
I've heard too that was an ad lib.
Well, it's gold.
That scene from
it's
Dumb and Dumber.
It's comedy gold.
There was just like guys standing outside of the convenience store that they were recording at, and Jim Carrey just ran with it. Yeah.
Well, it was amazing. So
beautiful.
That's how I talk to people. Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
Moving on, and I should say I don't think if we acknowledged it, and people have kind of heard, or maybe that we have a special guest today. Inadvertently and somewhat unwillingly called onto today.
He's not supposed to be here.
He's not supposed to be here today.
I wasn't even supposed to be here today.
Yep, 100%.
He's very clerks.
My husband, Tom, who has some thoughts and things about the films that we're going to discuss today, and I'm sure
he's being a good sport.
He will try to show some restraint in his opinions about these films out of respect for our listening audience.
Mm-hmm.
The films. But welcome, Tom.
Hi. Welcome. All right. So I'm going first. You did your two.
Absolutely, yeah. So we have synopsis. three films that we're coming going over today, and Meredith is going to cover Unbreakable, and then I'm gonna give us a little information on Split and Glass.
That's
and then I think that maybe we should just kind of roll through our synopsis in general, and then once that's all done, then we can kind of break it down.
Yeah.
Since normally we have a little chat before we start recording about what we're going to talk about and when, and we did not today.
Doing it live.
That's fine.
Yep.
This 100% is like, this is how the sausage is made, you know.
Ew.
In my bedroom. Okay. So, Unbreakable.
We'll segue from that.
It was the laugh that really sold it.
Okay. The Unbreakable, actually, okay, so we made a mistake on our last recording, which our listeners have not listened to yet. We talked about, we said that Signs was his follow-up to
No, we said Unbreakable
Sixth Sense,
was his sophomore.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so
because it came out the immediate year after, wasn't it?
No, you're right. No.
Sixth Sense was 99 and Unbreakable was 2000.
Okay, so I'm self-correcting something we got.
You're self-correcting a mistake we didn't make.
Great. So Unbreakable came out in 2000. And it opens with a woman in a department store who just had a baby, and a doctor comes in to help, and he tells her that her baby is in distress. The baby's arms and legs are broken, and it's very kind of awful.
Yeah, not in good shape.
Yeah. So then later on a train in modern days, because you can kind of tell at
that
the
was
opening
like 70s-ish.
Scene was a while ago. David Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, is on a train, and the train is on its way back to Philadelphia, and it derails. Tragically, all the passengers were killed except for David. David's wife, Audrey, played by Robin Wright, and his son, Joseph, come to pick him up. They all seem to realize the gravity slash miracle of his lone survival, like him coming out of this completely unscathed. Yeah,
and kind of mystery, like they... Tom noticed when we were watching this that they, and I feel like that was the only moment they, he was in. The doctor that speaks to David in the hospital is...
Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
And House of Cards.
And House of Cards, yeah. And I don't even, I feel bad for not knowing that actor's name, but...
Shoot.
He's a very recognizable guy, but like, he's in it for like...
2 seconds?
45 seconds.
Yep.
And that's it.
Yeah. He has a very like haunting, calm voice.
Yeah. Like, he's got like kind of like sunken eyes and like a really big dome.
It's, yeah. He has a big forehead. And,
big forehead.
He's very like, do you realize you're the only
what?
Person?
What? Was just what? You're the only
it's
survivor.
It's you and one other person. And he's about to die. And yeah. You're like, what? Okay. Well, see you later. Okay. So the memorial is held for the victims of the derailment. It's a lot of people, over 100 people who died in this terrible train crash. And David finds a card on his car with a brand, the name, it's labeled on the front or whatever. It's called limited edition on it. And it, that asks, how many days have you been sick in your life? He starts to think about it and realizes after a little bit, he's never really been sick.
Now that you mention it.
Yeah. He's like, hey, he asked his wife, he asked his employer. He's like, have I ever taken a day off?
Yeah.
You know, because I've been sick. And I was wondering, I was like, how do you not notice
how do
if you're
you
sick
not
or not?
Notice that? Yeah. Like, why do you need to ask your boss how many sick days you've taken
yeah,
if you've never taken a single one?
Yeah. And then I'm like thinking, well, he's like depressed, maybe, like checked out maybe. Like, I have no idea. So, checked out of life, not noticing. Anyway.
He's still stuck back in Nakatomi Plaza.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, back in time, a little boy, Elijah, is sad and refusing to leave the house. He has a broken arm and is worried about getting hurt and being in pain again. His mother tries to coax him out of the house. She leaves a nice gift for him out at the playground across the street, and it is his first comic. Now it's present day, and Elijah is the owner of a fancy art gallery, limited edition, and it's a gallery that's devoted to really fancy, like, comic book art.
High-end shit.
Mm-hmm, high-end stuff. David and Joseph go to talk to him about the card that he left in the truck. He plants the seed in David that he may be something more than human. Superhero, perhaps.
What?
He thinks it's ridiculous and leaves. But does he think it's ridiculous? Because it kind of...
Dot, dot, dot.
He kind of is like...
I've never been sick.
I've never been sick. So then he goes later into his closet to look at newspaper clippings that paint a story. He used to be a football star until a car wreck. And when he was in college. He sees the parallels between his current miracle that he just survived a train accident... and that he also had survived a car accident. His reverie is interrupted when his wife, Audrey, she chats with him a little bit, and she tells him she wants to reconcile. They're on the outs, and things are rocky between them.
He sleeps upstairs, and she sleeps downstairs.
Yeah, so. Later, David is at work, and Elijah comes to talk to him. He works for a college football the college, and he just works security. He chats with David and asks, you know, why did you go into protection, like security? He's like, you could have gone into anything, and you felt this inclination to protect people. David...
he's like, well, Starbucks turned me down.
Yeah. He's observing, there's hundreds and hundreds of people, a crowd coming in for a football game, and he mentions to Elijah that he feels this one man is carrying a gun. And Elijah prods him more. He's like, well, what did you picture? And he's like, I just, you know, in my head, I got a picture of a guy with a gun in his pants, and it has a black handle and silver gun. He asks, you know, Elijah wants to know more. And then he's like, it's not really, you know, it's whatever. It's fine. And he kind of brushes him off. He's like, I got to go to work. You know, I'll maybe we'll see you later, whatever. So Elijah leaves, and Elijah's, tries to tell him, he's like, well, you might have an instinct for this, that it might be something more. So then Elijah tries to go talk to the man that David said has a gun and get confirmation and see if David was right. Mm-hmm. And while he's pursuing this man, he falls down, you know, so many stairs. And I forgot to mention that Elijah has this disease where bone disease where he breaks his bones very easily. And he gets a glimpse of the gun. But he unfortunately got really, really injured.
Also gets smashed to shit falling down the stairs.
Yeah, while he was pursuing this man. So later, Joseph is helping David work out. Joseph, remember, is David's little boy. He's really a little cutie. Yeah. And the two of them discover that he is incredibly strong.
Than he knows.
Yeah, so David's like, at first he tricks David and he's like, you put too much weight on it. And he's like, I'm sorry, I'll help you. Right. He put on so much weight.
I'll take
on
off more.
I'll take it off. And then David doesn't really watch him. And he adds more actually. And then, he can lift all of it, including paint cans and all this other stuff. Yeah, so
it's like, 350 or like something, like where it's not superhuman, it's not like completely unattainable for like a human man to be able to lift, but it's pretty high end.
Well, I think it's just like he feels like his limits are there, but then once he reaches limits, he can do more. I think that whatever he can lift is probably like just
whatever's
in his head.
Put on him,
or his limit is his he'll head, be able to lift.
Yeah,
right. So then, let's see. So he's kind of thinking he might be more than human.
He's like, wait, am I the shit right
am
now?
Am I just awesome?
Am I incredible?
Joseph is getting convinced too.
Yeah.
While this is happening.
Because what little boy wouldn't want to believe that his dad is some
amazing, like, strong man.
Yeah.
So Elijah goes to talk to Audrey, who is an occupational therapist, I think, and she's helping.
Yeah, and that's the point where, like, accidents. I don't know if he, like, pulls some sort of strings to make sure, because he legitimately gets injured and legitimately is put into the medical system for treatment and everything. And then he ends up her patient as a physical therapist to help him recover from the injuries that he sustained falling down those stairs. But it's like, how could he have masterminded that? Like, it's not like he deliberately incurred those injuries so that he would be her patient, so that he would have that connection. But no. It seems like that connection that he has with her ends up being really, really essential to the development of the plot.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that he just was able to figure out how to be her patient.
He's like, hey, that girl, I want her. Buttercup, bring it on.
Audrey, help me bend my legs a little bit. Okay, so so Elijah goes to Audrey and she explains that she and David got into an accident in college and then he had to quit football. But she also tells Elijah that she would have been with a guy like that. She didn't want to be with a football player.
Yeah.
So also David knew this. So then later, Joseph gets into a fight at school. And while there, David's told by the very geriatric school nurse. She's like, you know,
I had you when you were a boy here. Yeah.
She's like, you don't remember me? And he's like, no. And she's like, you almost drowned. Like, you were pulled out of the pool. So he finds out this information. It's key information that he almost drowned in the school pool when he was a little boy. So then that night, he calls Elijah later, like, you know, this is what happened. I almost drowned.
Yeah.
You know, or like he goes to tell him. I can't remember. Oh, let me go back, because he tells him in person, I think. So then that night, to prove that David is a superhero, Joseph has a gun out and he says, I'm just going to shoot you to prove that you're a superhero. And
that scene was crazy. Yeah. Like a little boy pulling a gun on his dad in front of his dad and his mom being like, it's okay, I'm going to shoot you to prove you're a superhero. And both his parents are like, put the fucking gun down.
Yeah. And then David's like, yeah, but you're right. I'll be fine, but it'll ricochet off of me and someone else can get hurt. And you know what? And I'll go pack up my stuff and I will leave.
Mm-hmm.
So put the gun down.
Yeah.
So then luckily Joseph is convinced to put the gun down. Everyone has breathed a sigh of relief and is kind of really freaked out. Then at the comic book store later at some point, Elijah throws a tantrum because David had told him that he isn't a superhero because he almost drowned. So Elijah, in his tantrum, suddenly realizes that every superhero has a weakness, including right. David.
Yeah.
And he's still right about him, he feels.
Yeah.
So then David returns to the train to kind of check it out. And then he, you know, that's when his secret is sort of revealed to the audience. You know, he and Audrey, they were in a car accident that was legitimate, but he was not injured. And he superhumanly pulled the door off the car mm-hmm. and was able to rescue Audrey. And then he said, oh, I'm so hurt. Like, he, you know, because he knew she didn't want to be with him if he was a football player. He loved her.
Right.
And this was his out, basically. Yeah. So then he calls Elijah to tell him, you know, what happened. He's like, I wasn't injured.
Yeah.
Actually, you're right. Mm-hmm. And then Elijah tells him to go to a place with a lot of people. So he goes to a train station full of people, and I have it in quotes because his way of seeing is like he will brush against a person, like their shoulder contact, or whatever, and he'll see kind of who they are on the inside.
Yeah, or what they see or what they're doing.
Right. And quickly we see a lot of people are horrible.
Yeah.
You know, people are horrible around him.
Which, unfortunately, is probably really the case. If you were able to do that and go in a public place, you would see a lot of ugly stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of horrible people. But the worst was a man who went in and killed a family.
Yes.
A maintenance worker pushing a big cart full of stuff. Yeah,
like it was like home invasion.
Yes, a home invasion.
Yeah.
So David goes to follow him, and the children are tied up, and he rescues the children. The parents have died. He almost drowned in the process in the above ground pool with a tarp or something over it. But the children kind of help him.
Yeah.
Come.
No, and that's funny because that scene to me is like particularly terrifying, but also kind of comical because it's very similar to a scene in, is it Lethal Weapon 1 or Lethal Weapon 2 where they shoot and he falls off of a balcony into a pool and he lands on the plastic pool tarp and that idea that it's, you're not just drowning, it's like suffocation and drowning happening at the same time because you fall into this piece of plastic onto a body of water.
It's like wrapping you up like a burrito.
Exactly. And it's like, you're not just drowning because if you were in water, you could like swim to the surface, but you're not just suffocating because you're surrounded by water. And so I feel like that's a pretty terrifying situation that they put David in.
Yeah, it's crazy. And luckily the kids that he untied and rescued, they hand him.
They were like, we like this guy.
Yeah, it's like
a pool skimmer.
Yes,
yeah.
He was able to pull himself out, thankfully. So the, he almost has drowned, but he rescues the children and the parents have died. So then later the following morning, David goes and Audrey and he reconcile. David shares what he did very covertly with his son Joseph with a newspaper
page.
And Joseph's eyes like widened, and in the end David goes to a gathering / kind of it's a show at Elijah's art studio where he talks to his Elijah's mom for a moment, like
And she
says kind of very it's pretty great, but she's like, there are the monsters or the villains that fight you with a muscle, and then there's the other villain that fights you with their mind,
right?
And that's the super villain, basically, like the big bad guy.
Spoiler alert, that's your kid.
So David shakes Elijah's hand at this point, and then he realizes how absolutely awful Elijah is.
Oh my God, yes.
He is a criminal mastermind who is responsible for not only the train crash, but many, many more tragedies that killed people in his quest to find
the one unbreakable person.
Yeah, the unbreakable person. And in the end, there are captions at the end that kind of say what happened after. He turns in Elijah, who's locked up in a facility for the mentally insane. And that is Unbreakable.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, and I do think that, like, we should just kind of roll through the whole trilogy before we, you know, kind of react to the individual films independently. Are you on board with that?
Yep.
All right.
I'm drinking my tumbler of gin and tonics.
She's like, you do whatever the fuck you want.
Gin and tonics?
Yep.
because it's two.
Had a girl.
Two and one.
That's my girl. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Unbreakable came out in 2000.
Yes.
Right? So the sequel, the second part of this trilogy came out in 2016, which is like, that's a huge gap for a trilogy. And also when you look at M. Night Shyamalan's career, like the number of films he made in the interim, like there was no indication that he intended to continue this story or continue to develop it at any point. But then in 2016, he comes back with the film Split.
Which I only just watched for this.
Really? You'd never seen it before?
No, I think... No. I mean, I really actually like James McAvoy, and me I like Anya Taylor-Grace. I just couldn't commit to... It just made me anxious. Even watching the trailer gives me, like, a stomach ache.
Okay, so because like, so, this is, of the three movies, like this is the one I would save on a desert island. So, Split, it came out in 2016. So, we have three young girls. One of them, Casey, who's played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who we love. She made The Menu. She made The Witch, which we didn't love. But she's done a lot of...
Queen's Gambit, which we love.
She's a really spectacular actress.
She's right here on my computer.
Yeah, she is. Look at her. See? There she goes.
There she is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Casey, Claire, and Marcia are the three girls who get abducted. And Claire is played by an actress, Haley Lou Richardson, who is also a pretty recognizable and, you know, respected.
Is that the blonde performer. Lady? Or the blonde chick? Yeah. She's in White Lotus, the most recent one.
Okay. We haven't watched any White Lotus, but I've seen her in a lot of stuff, and she's really talented.
Okay.
So we've got these three girls, Casey, Claire and Marcia are abducted by this guy played by James McAvoy. He holds them in a dungeon like room. And we know from the start that Casey is different from the other girls. You know, initially read like she's not popular. The other two girls are popular and she isn't.
She's basically like, why do we have to invite her?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But we understand that better as we see her exhibiting some uncanny survival instincts. So we're like, oh, so she's better. She's different and she's better. She's the one that's going to live.
She doesn't suck as much as these bozos.
Exactly. Plus, we get some flashback scenes of her childhood hunting with her dad and her uncle. And so it's like, oh, so she's got some real world shit experience.
Yeah.
She knows how to shoot shit. I don't know. I don't know how that's valuable. But
it is later.
It does come in. So we see James McAvoy's character meeting with his therapist, whose name is Dr. Fletcher. And through that meeting and further interactions between him and the girls that he is holding prisoner, we come to understand that he has DID, which is dissociative identity disorder, which is often called multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is kind of like sometimes... I don't know how that aligns with the term multiple personalities, like schizophrenia, like what you know, from an actual scientific standpoint.
I don't know those diagnoses. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But anyway, DID is an accepted phrase for a disorder, dissociative identity disorder. And he has 23 personalities,
uh-huh.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
That's quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a lot to have in your head. So we learn that Dr. Fletcher holds an unpopular opinion that patients with DID might actually be a higher life form than regular humans. So we're like, oh, okay. So that's she doesn't view it as, therapeutically, she doesn't view it as a psychological disadvantage. She's like, oh, these people are actually, you know, more advanced or more evolved than we are. And we also observe that there is a struggle between all the personalities within James McAvoy's character who are all aware of each other's existence. So that's kind of interesting that, like, it's not like, oh, who are you? Like, they all know that there's 23 different people sharing this space inside this one person, and they refer to it as the light. Like, mm-hmm. Whoever is in the light is the one that's able to communicate with the outside world at that time.
Basically in the driver's seat.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But they all know that there's all these different personalities. It's not like they're oblivious to the fact that there are different personalities in this one human.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the girls, first Claire and then Marcia, try to escape from his captivity, obviously, and end up being isolated from the others until ultimately it's just Casey who is trying to manipulate and play the identities against each other to escape or get rescued. Because she's clearly the savvier, smarter, like more like worldly, like she's had, you know, life experiences that cause her to be more able and aware of like, how can I get out of this bad situation, where the other two girls are like, ah, I'm just going to scream and pound on the wall. Let me, you know, try and figure out how to get out of here.
She's a survivor who's very, like, has to figure out how, like, she's got the skill set to kind of figure out how to manipulate, talk her way out of, do what she can to survive.
She understands that, like, she needs to work within the situation to try and make her, to keep herself safe and try and get out. But then ultimately the worst flashback that we get, because there's like multiple flashbacks of Casey to like when she's a childhood. We see one that implies that on a hunting trip, her uncle assaulted her, seems to be sexually assaulted her.
Well, he says also he used to, you know, come on, we do this all the time. I think he says something like that, where this is something that's not.
Not new.
A one-off. It seems like very probably common.
Yeah. So you were like, awful. Oh, no. Oh, poor baby. Like, you're just really bummed out.
You're like, man,
that bummed you hard.
That actor, actually, he always creeps me out. And he, funny enough, he passed away a few years ago. And I was like.
The actor that played the uncle?
Mm-hmm. And I was like, I didn't like him, but I'm sure he was like a normal, nice, kind person, right?
No, in like real life, I'm sure he was fine.
But then he played like horrible people all the time.
You're like, God damn it, good riddance.
God damn it. I really want to be like good riddance, but then also rest in peace.
Yeah. It's a real struggle.
Yeah. When you're too good at your job.
But then there's also another flashback scene that shows that her father dies when she's still a little girl and her uncle gets custody of her. So you're like, oh, so you're going to continue to be abused indefinitely by this piece of shit. So there are therapy conversations continue and reveal that some of the personalities within this James McAvoy's person believe in a creature called Beast. That is one of them, even though Dr. Fletcher tries to convince them otherwise, because she says like their understanding of all the personalities within this one human is they're all in the same room and it's whoever has the light is the one that's speaking. And she's like, the Beast isn't in the room. So if he's not there, he's not one of you. He doesn't exist. He's not a real person. But they're convinced, and some personalities in particular, convinced the Beast is this creature that, you know, has these characteristics, these physical characteristics and this power that they don't have. And they're really fixated on it. So the other piece of information is that these girls have been kidnapped and are being held hostage because the Beast has to be fed on those who have not suffered. Like that's the source of his nourishment. Like that's what the other personalities that are trying to support him and whatever are they need to supply him with individuals that have not suffered. So it's like, oh, these little like cheerleader, perfect girl, high school girls that are like, you know, whatever, they haven't had anything bad happen to them in their life. Like that's going to be his nourishment. That's his food.
Yeah, don't go to the art wing of the high school with all the weird goth kids.
Stay the fuck out of there.
You won't find anything.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, we do have all of these different personalities behaving within this one individual. And what keeps happening is that some of them, they'll, like, get an opportunity, they'll get the light for a moment, and they'll send an email when they have the light to the therapist being like, oh my God, help. But then by the time the therapist responds to whatever, a different personality has taken over and shows up and is like, everything's fine. It's no problem. And the therapist is like, yeah, but I kind of think that someone else is reaching out to me. Is it not just you?
They're like, psh, nah,
it's fine.
Not at all. It's good. It's all good.
So in response to one of those emails, Dr. Fletcher actually comes to visit at, you know, where this person lives and discovers the girl's held hostage. Then she herself is pepper sprayed by the dude. She's like,
spray,
oh,
right?
Shit, no, it's me.
It was, what do you call it? Chloroformed?
No, he sprayed her. I thought it was a mace.
No, it was something that would make you pass out. So like a chloroform kind of something.
Yeah. He incapacitated her.
Yes, incapacitate.
Yes.
He's like, let me just put you to sleep. Go to sleep.
It's all fine. It's all fine. It's good. And so in the next few scenes, James McAvoy's character cycles through all the personalities as he moves around the city before finally transforming into the Beast, this character that has, you know, this these physical characteristics and everything that's beyond what the human element of the of this person has had in the past. And that the Beast runs home where the girls are all trying to get free, like, God bless them.
They're like very animalistic too. He was like just like running with his hands waving in the air. He was
running on all fours, like there's definitely his physical behavior is not, it's not humanoid.
No.
And so that kind of supports this idea that, like, it's not just a guy with a psychological disorder, there's something else going on here.
Yeah, more than human. Like somebody else in another movie.
Dun, dun, dun. So he's heading back to the house. And when he arrives, he finds Dr. Fletcher and he actually crushes her to death. He, like, you know, wraps his arms around her and, like, literally crushes her to death, which is a pretty intense scene. Before feasting on the other girls, he just, like, num 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 num. He eats the shit out of the other girls as an animal would. Like, and that's the thing, is that as the Beast, he's a
lion.
He's not human anymore. He's some sort of beast. He's a creature, and so he's eating. He's feasting on these other girls that have been held captive. Casey, on the other hand, as our one wise and savvy lady, she does get out of her captivity, and she finds the bodies of the other her classmates. She's like, "Oh, tears."
She's like, "Who are you again?"
Oh, that's okay. Right. We had biology together.
How was your birthday once? Your birthday party.
You kind of sucked.
Then we got kidnapped together. Trauma bonding, though. We're best friends now.
Hashtag trauma bonding.
Oh, my best friend. Okay.
Yep. So she finds those bodies. She also finds Dr. Fletcher's body, as well as a note that Dr. Fletcher was able to write with the name of. And see, this is the thing, like, James McAvoy's character at this point, like, we don't really know. We don't know what to call him. We don't know who he is.
Who was he when he was born?
Exactly, exactly. And so the note from Dr. Fletcher that Casey finds has James McAvoy's character's real name, which is Kevin Wendell Crumb. And so that was the name of the actual citizen of the United States, the human being that existed before all of his personalities fractured and his relations with the therapist and everything, all of the evolution, like, Kevin Wendell Crumb was who he was at the outstart. And so Casey uses that name to summon the actual man back. So she, like, it's almost like, I don't know, it's like a fairy tale. Like, if you say his name, he'll appear.
Like Rumpel,
you know, it's like Candyman shit.
Rumpelstiltskin.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm getting you what do you call it? So I can escape, make my great escape. I would just say your name and run off.
And so she says, Kevin Wendell Crumb, Kevin Wendell Crumb, Kevin Wendell Crumb. And that, like, you know, tricks the Beast, like, causes the Kevin's personality to present, to come to the forefront, to awareness. And he's like, wait, what the fuck is going on right now? Like, he's lost 2 years of time. Like, he's lost all this time to all these other personalities and his psyche fracture and everything. So he's in bad shape. And his response to that is that he was like, yeah, fuck all of this. And so he tells Casey where his shotgun is stored and where the ammunition is stored, that so that she can kill him, because he recognizes that he's a fucking hot mess. And he's like,
he's like, I killed my doctor. I gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, exactly. He sees Dr. Fletcher's body and he was like, what happened? Who did that? I did that. And so it's that, like, recognizing that he is, you know, beyond help in his psychological condition. And he's like, this is where my gun is. This is whatever. Please kill me.
I was being too much of a scamp.
Yeah. But mission accepted. Mm-hmm. But then the other personalities retake control, and Casey, you know, watches through them all cycle too, and she's like dealing with and she's starting to get to know and recognize all of the different personalities that are present in this individual and like how to react to them, because that's what she was doing previously when she was being held prisoner and she was trying to figure out how she could save herself and escape. She was like trying to get to know the different personalities and how she could potentially play them.
Yeah, she's like, you know, they talk about you. They talk about you.
You know, they think you suck.
They think you're like the worst and very dumb. She didn't say that, but I mean, essentially, yeah, yes. Yeah, it was kind of. Like, what, who's saying that about me? That's so rude, et cetera.
Et cetera. So she does manage. She gets the shotgun. She loads it. She has a final chase and showdown with the Beast, because at that point, like, the James McAvoy character has, like, completely, like, transformed into the Beast character. And she does shoot him twice, like center mast in his torso with the shotgun, but it doesn't harm him. And this is like, you know, kind of feeding into the idea that the therapist was introducing, and that kind of carries the story forward, is that he's superhuman in some way. Like, he could be shot twice with a shotgun in the chest and be totally fine. And at that point, it seems like, oh, fuck, it's Casey's time is up. Like, she's on her way out. But then the long sleeve shirt that she's been wearing this whole time is like ripped and finally thrown aside. And the Beast sees that she is covered in scars.
Yeah.
And you don't really know at that point if they are abuse scars from her uncle, like he's been cutting her or burning her, or if they're self-inflicted, like self-harming, because she's been abused all this time. So she's been self-harming. But her whole, like her shoulders, her torso, her belly, like everything that's exposed when her shirt comes off is just covered in scarring. And so it's like, it's really, really tragic. And, so the Beast sees that, and he realizes that she's different from the other girls. And the phrase that he says to her is, the broken are the more evolved. Mm-hmm. Because the whole idea is that the Beast is, the reason that they, like, targeted these, like, stupid high school teeny bopper girls is, like, they've never suffered. Like, those are the people we want to feed on. But when he recognizes that this is someone that has suffered, this is somebody that's, you know, had trauma, had pain in her life, it's like, this isn't somebody that he wants to feed on. This isn't what he's looking for. And so he recognizes that in Casey, and he runs off. So Casey's found by an employee of the zoo, and which is what this whole nightmare is taking place under. It turns out it was all under a zoo the whole time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Philadelphia Zoo.
Like some sweet, innocent little zoo employee. It was like,
I'm just taking a smoke break.
Hey, what the fuck are you doing down here?
This is a restricted section. What are you doing over here?
What are you doing down here? So the closing scenes of the film, we see the man, and this is James McAvoy's character, all his personalities partying together, and they're celebrating that the Beast is unstoppable because they've escaped, they've been shot with a shotgun, and they weren't killed, so they're, like, pretty confident that, like, yeah, we're evolved, we're something exceptional, we can't be killed. And then there's a final scene in a diner where there's a news report of the events giving the man that the reports are talking about the nickname of the Horde, because he has all these multiple personalities. And there's a woman at the counter in the diner who's wondering aloud, oh, wasn't there some other guy in a wheelchair that was locked up 15 years ago that they gave a weird nickname to? And next to her, a man offers the name Mr. Glass. And that is Bruce Willis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, and so that was like, because when you think about, again, there was a really long time gap between Unbreakable and Split. And so to have that little Easter egg, to have that connection at the end of Split that was linking it back to the Unbreakable storyline was really significant. But yeah, so that was the final scene, and you were like, bah, bah, bah! And that was the end of Split.
Mm-hmm. Continue.
Okay.
Book number three. That's right.
Book number three. Yes.
Movie number three.
Let's power through. So Split came out in 2016. The final film of the trilogy came out in 2019, which is called Glass. And it takes place not long after the close of the previous movie, but the 3-year time difference between the release of the films I thought was kind of strange because, like, Casey, she was in high school in Split, and she's still in high school in Glass, and, like, 3 years. I don't know. I mean,
No, they said it was 3 weeks later.
Yeah, so...
In the movie.
They're so, like, oh, they were like, forget how long it took us to take the movie. It's 3 weeks later.
Yeah. That's fine.
Sure.
That's
why not?
Movies work.
That is... absolutely. Okay. Let's do it. Because we're... so I have, it's not long after the close of the previous movie. So David, who's Bruce Willis's character, has been an acting superhero-esque vigilante.
He has like a business even.
Yeah, he does.
Devoted to security and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have that like huge gap in time between Unbreakable and Split. And so now we're like, in the future with everything. And his son, Joseph, who is actually, God bless him, the same actor, Spencer Treat Clark, who played his son in the original, also plays his son in Glass. And he was in a thread on Special Victims Unit.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, no, he's adorable.
Yeah, he's a handsome fellow.
He's a good guy.
I'm not a creep when I say that about him being in the 2020 or 2019 movie.
Yeah,
because he's an adult man.
Yeah, you're like, I cannot be arrested or detained for my statement that he is a cutie.
He's a little cutie patootie, and he's got these beautiful blue eyes. And
yeah, he does.
Yeah, he seems like a sweet, sweet kid.
But it is the same actor that played Bruce Willis's son in Unbreakable plays his son, reprises the role in Glass. And so Joseph, the son, has been helping Bruce Willis in his superhero vigilante efforts.
What do you call it? Mission Impossible, where he's like in the background, like click, 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 click.
Yeah, he's the guy. He's the guy on that.
Yeah. He's like, okay, so over here, and let me look up that property and who owns that. Oh, this guy's a bad guy and whatever. So it's kind of funny. He's like in his dad's ear.
Exactly.
Kind of,
wasn't it? What is the phrase? Because it was in the new Spider-Man's with Tom Holland, that character who's like, I want to be your guy in the chair. Remember? Nothing?
No.
Okay. Because his Tom Holland's high school friend, that guy, like, that was his whole attitude toward, because he was the only one that knew that Tom Holland was Spider-Man.
Right.
He was like, I want to be the guy in the chair. And he was the actor that was in Tarot that we went to see that was so devastatingly horrible. Anyway.
I will not be watching that.
Good.
Looked terrible.
On the flip side, this character, Joseph, is adorable and wonderful, and we don't hate him at all. So Casey, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, is still in high school, but she's living with a foster family because she finally reported on her piece of shit uncle and got removed, and now she's with a foster family. And the Horde, James McAvoy and all his personalities, have continued kidnapping girls in the effort to feed the beast. David encounters Hedwig, which is one of the Horde's personalities, on the street from brushing against his hand, and realizes who he is and where the recent batch of girls that have been kidnapped are being held. So David rescues those girls and he fights the beast, like they have their whole battle. But in the process, they both end up being arrested and institutionalized in the same hospital as Mr. Glass has been held all these years.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh my God, is everything coming together? I had no idea this
was
going to happen.
It was meant to be.
Oh my God. It's like there's a writer writing all this shit. So we meet a new therapist who's Dr. Staple, who is, oh my God, am I blanking on her name right now?
Who? Sarah Paulson?
Yes! Mm-hmm. Sarah Paulson, who is incredible on all of the American Horror Story seasons that she's been on.
Mm-hmm.
She is so fantastic.
Yeah, she also played Nurse Ratched for
one.
They only did one season, I think.
No.
But but she was great in that too. She's just crazy and awesome. I love her.
She has an incredible delivery and persona, and she's just perfect for certain characters, for certain roles. She's absolutely right. And so I feel like this is one of them, where she is the therapist who specializes in the psychosis of patients believing that they are a superhero. And she is working with all three of these patients, Mr. Glass, with David, and with the Horde. In the process, while she's working with her, Joseph comes. He pleads for his dad's release. Like, oh, you didn't know. He's not. He didn't think he's a superhero. He was just trying to help some people. It's no big deal. And then also Casey comes to visit to meet with James McAvoy's character. And she actually manages to summon Kevin out of the Horde and make that connection. And it's like this little mini sliver of a romance story where you're like, oh, if only, like, her and Kevin, like, it could be such a beautiful thing, because, like, she's suffered and he's suffered and they have that connection. And when she's able to draw Kevin's personality out in this person, like, Kevin, when he presents, he's this incredibly, like, empathetic and tragic and suffering, like, personality. And she's like, oh, you know, hi, it's me. And he's like, oh my God, it's you. And it's like this beautiful moment. And then fucking the rest of the Horde shows up and ruins everything.
Yeah.
But anyway, so
like they like to do. And they're well, get the fuck out of here, Kevin.
I know. I hate that when my multiple personalities do that. But anyway, so Casey also visits and has communications with Kevin. And of course, Elijah's mom, who is she's very present in Unbreakable when, you know, we see him as a young guy and his disorder and his hyper breakability.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's actually called. I don't remember what it's called.
Yeah, it's a fancy term.
Yeah, and I didn't bother to write it down.
That's fine. That's totally fine. But anyway, so his mom is still regularly visiting him at the institution.
And she's even, like, he's lost his spark. He's just all sad all the time.
I would, even though everyone thinks he is persistently and debilitatingly sedated.
Catatonic.
Yep. Because they're like, he's too smart for all of us, so we just keep him completely tanked up.
Just like, fuck him up all the time.
Absolutely. But of course, in actuality, he is not. He is outsmarting all of them, even when Dr. Staple thinks that she's actually giving him a lobotomy. She is not, because he stole some shit out of the lobotomy machine and it doesn't actually happen. So he manipulates the Horde. So James McAvoy's, like, character and all of the personalities that he has, he manipulates those personalities to help him escape, while also manipulating David, saying that he's going to orchestrate an attack where the Beast presents himself to the whole city at the opening of a new skyscraper in the city. So Mr. Glass is just pulling all these fucking strings. Right,
David's
left.
Like, what? I gotta stop it.
That is unacceptable. I will not allow for that.
Not on my watch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Give me my poncho.
Where's my? It's gotta be one of these buckets somewhere. So the culminating scene has, like, so Joseph, Eliza's mom, and Casey, like, they're the three characters that are the representatives of the three individuals that are, like, superhero, not superhero, supervillain, whatever. Like, you have the counterpoints for each of them. You have the three people institutionalized and then the three people out in society that are invested
people
in
people that
them.
Are their people, kind
exactly.
of.
Exactly.
Casey kind of unwittingly.
Yeah. No, ended she, up in this. Bless her heart. I mean, and that's what girls do, right? They find the most.
She's like, I just need help.
Broken
I need
bastard
to help him.
To fixate
needs,
on.
He just needs a.
He just needs
a little
you
love.
Know, someone
I can fix
take him to. Whole Foods. I don't know.
I can mix them. This is fine.
It's totally fine, Mom. Joseph, Elijah's mom, and Casey are all at the hospital at the same time that all three patients break out. David is battling the Beast out there on the grounds in front of the hospital until Joseph, like, rushes out and drops this bombshell that he's uncovered that Kevin's fate, fucking words, Kevin's father.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the, the Beast's, like, if you go to his fundamental personality, Kevin, the person that he started at, his father died in the train crash that Mr. Glass orchestrated to kind of find the existence of David.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like Mr. Glass, you know, and Unbreakable, that was the whole thing. Like, he was orchestrating all of these huge disasters to try and identify the one human being that could survive a mass disaster.
Yeah.
And so there was, I think there was like three different examples in Unbreakable. There was, you know, and ultimately the train crash was the one. David survived, and that identified for him. This was the one person in that train crash. Kevin's father was on that same train and he was killed. And so Kevin had been in a household where his mother was abusive and mentally ill. And I don't know if it was Munchausen or whatever, but his dad was like, we're going to figure this out. I'm going to get help. I'm going to figure out, you know, what we're going to do about your mom. It's going to be fine. But then his dad died in the train crash that Mr. Glass produced. And so that left Kevin to be raised by this mentally ill parent that led to him having the mental fracture that produced all of his personalities and ultimately the Beast. And so that train crash that Mr. Glass orchestrated created the Beast, essentially.
And all of his childhood misery.
All of
and
the
neurosis.
Trauma. All the trauma. So Joseph has figured that out, and he... it was just like, hey, Beast, by the way, this guy over here, Mr. Glass, he's the reason that you're all fucked up.
See this
guy?
And
the Beast is like, whoa, 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 what?
He fucked up your life real good. So, how do you like them apples?
Absolutely. So, the Beast is funny. He's actually appreciative initially because we all know how much he values suffering. He likes the people that have suffered. He's not a fan of people who haven't suffered. But then he fatally wounds Mr. Glass anyway because, you
know. He's like, fuck you.
He's like, thank you for what you've done for me, but also die. Die now.
He's like, I'm done with you, squash.
Yeah, squashes him.
And he's like, oh, my bones.
Not hard to do.
Ouch, my bones. My bones are broken. I don't remember that.
That is a 100% accurate representation of this scene.
I'm recounting scene for scene all those dialogue. The dialogue that happened.
So then the Beast throws David into a giant water tank, which we all know water is David's weakness. So David breaks out of the tank, of course, because he's super strong, and he floods the area, which, you know, they show us that happens. Oh, look, it fills that pothole. Who would care if it filled a pothole?
Oh, no. What?
Katie? That's me.
That's wrong.
Casey. Casey manages to get to the Beast, and she re-conjures Kevin. She summons him back out of his personalities and tries to convince him that he is actually in control. And it's like this beautiful, romantic, perfect moment until a sniper shoots him in the torso. A sniper who we notice has a shamrock tattoo on his wrist. Meanwhile, another SWAT member who has been obviously called to this, you know, horrible scene... who also has a shamrock tattoo on his wrist, is drowning David in the pothole. Like, oh, you don't like water? Take that, asshole. Die in this pothole. And then the final shamrock tattoo that we see is on Dr. Stapleton's wrist herself. And it's revealed at that point that her purpose and that of her 10,000-year-old organization was always to destroy the superheroes. To, you know, eliminate them, to keep them out of society, to make sure to just neutralize them. And she tells Mr. Glass just before he dies from the wounds that he incurred from the Beast. She says, there just can't be gods among us. That is her mentality. So afterwards, she erases all the security footage of the conflict. She spreads the story that it was just the drugs in the patient's systems that caused them to be acting kooky.
Angel dust and PCP.
And she's ready to move on to the next city and the next job for her organization of suppressing superheroes until the final twist that Mr. Glass had actually hijacked the security cameras at the institution and the footage of the battle had been streamed to a private site. And it was ultimately sent to the three allies, which are Casey, Joseph, and Elijah's mom, who, of course, then post it online and share it with the world. And so that's the final scene of the film Glass is them revealing to the world this footage that is evidence that all of these individuals with superhuman or superhero or even supervillain capabilities existed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's it. That's the trilogy.
That's it.
Yeah. What'd you think, Meredith?
Okay. So I had zero opinion, obviously, about Split or Glass because I just watched it like 2 weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have to like think back to what I thought when I watched it originally or anything like I did when I watched Unbreakable. But I feel like when I overall, I know Unbreakable was really shit on when it came out in 2000.
Yep.
And that's like an understatement.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people present day after the other two movies came out, they're kind of walking that back a little bit because it was supposed to, like a lot of people, it was pre when everyone was using the internet, pre when people had internet on their phones and understanding like intent or what was coming after.
You mean for Unbreakable?
Movie. Yes.
Okay.
So I remember watching that movie and people were like, that movie sucked. And I was like, I liked it.
You're
and
like, I really feel like in 15 years he's going to make some.
Well, no, because I think that was what something he said. He's like, it's supposed to have a follow-up.
Okay.
It's supposed to be, there's supposed to be some more story after this. But it did so, people were so upset about it, he couldn't get it made.
Really?
For a good chunk of time, and he had to go and do other projects.
Right.
So eventually his vision was played out the way he intended, and it was really appreciated by everyone. But I just think the timing was bad. And other people who have written articles or blog or whatever about this movie in particular say it came out way ahead of its time.
Unbreakable.
Okay. It was before Marvel movies were coming out. It was before like all these superhero movies were coming out and getting a lot of focus and attention and fans, really. So I feel like it just kind of missed the timing, honestly. But I really liked it, and that movie I thought was really good. Honestly, though, when I watched it the first time, I remember seeing it in the theater. And when he goes to the house, he follows the guy, and he goes in the house, and there's a home invasion. And it was before we even really knew what a home invasion was. That wasn't really widely used, in our vernacular as people in the world. Like, we're like, oh, well, someone was robbed or whatever. He came and he killed the family. And now I'm like, oh, that was a home invasion. He came in, and he's, like, just hanging out, like, BTK killer hanging out with his family and killed these parents. And that's terrifying. And they have a fight and he falls into the water and there's children there. And I remember being like haunted when he like waves at the mom and does this like shh, makes a shh quiet sound. Bruce Willis's character. And then later when he unties her and she just falls dead on the floor because she had died.
Right.
I remember being like, oh my gosh, that's awful. That's so awful and like haunting. And I remember that scene stuck in my head for a long time. So, and I know, I think I was maybe 17 or 18 at the time. So to remember it so many years later and be like, I remember that.
Yeah. How made you feel?
Yeah. It means it was pretty impactful all these years later, rewatching it again. And then I didn't rewatch these other two movies. I watched them for the first time 2 weeks ago. So I didn't watch Split for a long, long time because I love, like I said, I love those actors. But it made me anxious, like the whole thing of being kidnapped and split personalities and having a struggle and her trying to escape and me being, I don't know, like I tend to gravitate towards that usually, honestly. Yeah. But I don't know why. I didn't want to watch it. So I finally watched it. And I was like, oh, I really liked it. I'm like, why was I so resistant to it? I don't know why. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. And I really thought it was fun. The character of the doctor adding all of this more like insight or context for what we were seeing.
The doctor in Split or the doctor in Glass?
In Split.
Okay.
So, you know, why were the personalities doing what they're doing? What was their motivation?
Yeah.
Who was in control? How do you get control? How do you, you know, what is the deal with this? How much is known? How much is still like stuff they're still trying to figure out about his condition and what he's dealing with? I thought that was really interesting. And, so I loved it. I thought it was really good. And then the third one, I didn't think it was really scary, you know, but well, I thought it was something that had to be done to just to end it.
I don't think scary is really a factor in any of these films.
No, with the exception of the home invasion scene in Unbreakable, which gave me the major creeps. I didn't really, mm-hmm. I wasn't really scared or anything like that. But I liked Glass. I feel like I liked Unbreakable the most, then mm-hmm. a Split, and then last would be Glass being in my ranking of the movies that I enjoyed. But did you find any of them scary slash entertaining? We can change this. The question.
Yeah. You always tweak the question. So I also saw Unbreakable. I didn't see it in the theater, but I know that I did see it relatively close to when it came out. And then Split and Glass, I watched them back when close to when they came out. So I was rewatching them for this recording. But in the preparation for this recording, I did obviously rewatch all of them. And so it was Tom's first opportunity to watch the film Unbreakable. Mm-hmm. And I would
you never watched it before?
No.
No. Oh, okay. And he was you saw Sixth Sense when it was new. Yeah. Yeah. But never watched Unbreakable.
No.
What did you think about Unbreakable now that with your recent watching for the first time?
Take Meredith's comments and multiply by minus one.
Minus one. Yeah.
What is that? What?
I did not share your opinion on the film.
Yeah.
What's that? How's that a minus one?
It's the opposite.
It's the mathematical opposite.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a fan.
No.
Oh, of Unbreakable?
Is there anything in particular about it that you thought didn't measure up?
I just didn't enjoy it.
Okay.
It wasn't, I don't know. It was kind of that thing where, you know, his movies are built up with, there's going to be a twist. I don't know.
Yeah. And there was a twist, at the end of Unbreakable, the revelation that Mr. Glass's character had orchestrated the tragedies, in an effort to identify Bruce Willis's character. Mm-hmm. But I agree that I remember when I watched Unbreakable the first time, I didn't think it was good. Mm-hmm. And then in rewatching it, it was more so like I didn't find it particularly entertaining. Like I didn't think that it brought anything to the table that would make you want to sit down and watch a film. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because we did the episode on Sixth Sense. And one of the things that I really talked a lot of on that about was how skillful M. Night Shyamalan is with his script writing and the dialogue, because with the Sixth Sense, he had to be so deliberate and particular with the language and the script writing that he did to create a scenario where Bruce Willis's character was dead, but nobody realized it because all of the language that he was giving the characters supported the idea that he could potentially be a living character in the story. Mm-hmm. And then he made Unbreakable where Bruce Willis didn't talk at all.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis didn't fucking talk at all. Like his character, the character of David Dunn is inherently understated, which I think is a beautiful thing. I'm all about a man, an understated man.
Yep.
Tom's
great. Well, I think also the whole reason he and Audrey are on the outs is because he's very a depressed person.
Yeah. And he's not communicative.
He's not communicative. He doesn't communicate and he doesn't share why. He doesn't know.
Yeah.
Why,
he doesn't where he's know feeling what this, his, this. Yeah.
He doesn't know grief. He's never been not sick.
Yeah,
he's like, he doesn't know that like, he almost drowned as a child.
Flu once.
Yeah.
He doesn't know where this grief is coming from. He doesn't know why he's not fulfilling this purpose. He's like, what am I missing?
Yeah.
And this is the big thing is that he's missing all what he should be doing. He doesn't know it, though, mm-hmm. until this villain, the supervillain, eventually points it out to him. It's funny, though, because I watched a little blurb. A little video of Quentin Tarantino a few months ago was like releasing little chats or whatever about his favorite movies. And he said Unbreakable is one of his favorites. And he's like, this is one of Bruce's best act, you know, one of his best performances. And I was like, I mean, I think it's really good, but he's like, he's just, I don't know. He just doesn't really, and he's worked with Bruce Willis, you know, whatever. Yeah. So yeah. I would assume
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. I would assume that they, I don't know. He's, but he's also a lover of film too. So,
mm-hmm. I thought he'd be a big Die Hard fan. Yeah. Bruce's feet being out the whole time.
Yeah. He's like, I just need to see your feet all the whole time.
The whole time.
No, but I mean, I think that it's something more than I would never say anything bad about Die Hard. I love that movie. But it's just, it seems a little bit more depth to that character.
No. There is no depth to a lot of Bruce Willis's work.
So I think maybe that's what he's referring to, possibly, but I'm not really sure.
Honestly, when I look at the films of Bruce Willis's,
hey, I love it. I'll watch it every Christmas, and it will always happen.
I'll watch it anytime I'm in labor.
Anytime you're in labor.
Count me out.
But that's the thing, like Bruce Willis, like I feel like he knows his lane. Like, when he's making an action movie, he's in his lane. He makes an action movie. He makes a Die Hard movie. He makes an Expendables movie, you know. And then with this, like, he made Sixth Sense with M. Night Shyamalan, and it was this enormous success. And it was a demonstration of what he's capable in terms of developing a character. And when then M. Night Shyamalan was, you know, and it's a lot of pressure for a filmmaker. For, you know, someone like M. Night Shyamalan, he's like, I'm a writer, I'm going to produce it, I'm going to direct it, I'm going to do everything. This is my film, this is my project. And he made Sixth Sense, and it was this huge success. And then the next year, he's like, okay, this is my next thing. And then that's a lot of pressure. And he brought the same big star in, he brought Bruce Willis back in, but he gave him a completely different persona.
Yeah.
Character. And the thing that tripped me up is that what M. Night Shyamalan does so incredibly is dialogue. Writing the dialogue for the characters that furthers the story, that creates the complexity, that sets the stage for whatever big twist or revelation he has at the end.
Yeah.
In Unbreakable, Bruce Willis didn't talk. He didn't talk. His character didn't speak.
Yeah,
there was no.
The dialogue was for Samuel L. Jackson. That was who was the person who was writing the dialogue. Yeah, absolutely.
But then you're fighting against the whole thing of like, it's Sam Jackson. Like, Sam Jackson is Sam Jackson no matter what director or what writer is writing his script, writing the character. And I love him, and I think that he fits every bill that he's ever filled. But like, he shows up and it's. It's him. He doesn't adjust or you know, reflect the nuances or the characteristics, you know, that might be individual to a filmmaker's particular story or idea for one film. Sam Jackson showed up in Unbreakable and he's like, oh, okay, I'm a supervillain? Yes. And he nailed it. He nailed it.
I love it when the guy comes, he's like, I'll take it. He's like, I love it for my 4-year-old. He's like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And that was quintessential like, Sam Jackson to do something
that. That's a tasty burger. That's you know, like all the stuff that he's known for. You're
exactly.
Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so he's a national treasure. We all know this.
Yeah. And so is Bruce Willis. And that's why for me, for them to be together in Unbreakable and for it to not really align, to not like fit or, you know, I don't know, like gel is a bummer.
Right.
And then,
I mean, I like Unbreakable, but I wouldn't say, oh, I have to watch it every year. I just think it's it's something I would enjoy once or twice in
maybe
my life,
twice.
Honestly.
Maybe and, twice? I don't know. Like, but know, it's I interesting to say what you said, like that he had, because my big thing, because if I were to describe this trilogy, I'm like, this is clunky.
Yeah.
Like, this is a trilogy. Trilogy does not work. It doesn't come across. But for you, the information that you had about the fact that maybe he wanted to make he wanted to continue the trilogy sooner.
Yes.
But because mm-hmm. Unbreakable wasn't well received, right. he couldn't.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes a little bit more sense. Because for me, if I look at these three films, I'm like, kill the other two, keep Split.
Split was great.
Split by it. It could stand alone.
But we're not even talking about James McAvoy, who was amazing.
Well, James McAvoy was incredible in Split and Glass. But of the three films, the movie Split could completely stand alone 100% from start to finish in the story, in the characters. You don't need any... You don't need the background information about Bruce Willis's character or Sam Jackson's character, anything, because what makes that film beautiful is James McAvoy's characterization of all the different personalities and Anya Taylor-Joy's characterization that she brings of we kidnapped these three dumb high school chicks, but we didn't expect to have this one that was super savvy and it had all this trauma and it's a really little worldwide. Black sheep
showing up and
exactly.
Everything up.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I think you'd watch Split. You could watch Split for sure without even needing to watch the other two.
Yeah. Skip the last scene.
Yeah. skip it. And you're like, who's that guy? Well, it doesn't matter. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's Bruce Willis. He seems it. No.
I feel like I know that guy.
You're mistaken.
Yeah. But for me, James McAvoy was what made this trilogy worthwhile, even though I love Bruce Willis. Tom knows.
We all know. Yeah.
He is a very, very important person to me. he's making a very uncomfortable face.
He's shaking his head. He's like, yes, I know.
Yeah, no, I'd rather not talk about how important Bruce Willis is to you. but in terms of these three movies, I feel like the thing that gives any of it merit is James McAvoy's performance.
Yeah,
and Anya Taylor-Joy, to be fair. The two of them, what they bring to Split, and then in extension perform in the film Glass, is what makes those two films interesting and entertaining. You're invested in it. But Unbreakable, what I remember from when I saw it the first time, and I was like, this sucks. I'm never watching that again. And then watching it again and trying to see the merit in it. And I am able to see some merit in it now, but the thing that I will still say is it is not an entertaining film.
No, I mean, honestly, it's a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, it's not one that you would want to put on because, action, the activity, there's nothing wrong with the storyline. There's something beautiful in him saving the family at the end, all of that. But in terms of a film as a whole, it is not entertaining.
Yeah. 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 I mean, Split, I still liked Unbreakable more, but I like Split.
You liked Unbreakable more than Split?
I said what I said.
Yeah, sure. Really? I said that, if you had to pick a film, you had to sit down and watch a movie, you would put Unbreakable on before Split.
I told you, though, that Split gave me a stomach ache. It made me anxious.
Yeah, but that's usually a good thing for you. Something giving you a stomach ache is usually a good thing.
My tummy. I can't. I'm anxious. No. Nope. I stand by my statement.
All right, so these three, your first is still Unbreakable.
No, you know, though, that I like weird movies.
It's not a weird movie, though. It's just a slightly bad movie.
I mean, I really like Jacob's Ladder. People have opinions about that.
What does he like?
No, I said I really liked Jacob's Ladder, and a lot of people have opinions about that.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I have my feelings that I had about Jacob's Ladder, but it's not like I had Jacob's Ladder to compare to two more films that were supposed to be in a trilogy or in a story arc with them. That's the thing.
I really liked the introduction of Elijah and how he came to be who he is.
Yeah, so and that's the thing. Like, I mentioned to Tom that one of the things that didn't make sense to me, because he was like, what the fuck do you expect any of this to make sense to you, is that in Glass, when Elijah's dying and his mom is with him, and she's the one that introduced him to comic books, and she, like, brought that into his life, and so she understands how that's the narrative of his, like, defining himself and everything. And she says something about, like, the final battle or whatever, and Sam Jackson says it was never whatever final something, it was an origin story. Mm-hmm. Like, that's his line at the end of Glass, and I'm like, of what origin story, of what, what, like, I don't,
of crap,
of because, like, if M. Night Shyamalan was planning on continuing, like, he was trying to create his own Marvel universe, like, maybe, and if the setup was supposed to be that David's son Joseph was gonna take over and he was gonna be super strong or something, but there was no indication of anything where the story was going to continue past the film Glass, and yet Mr. Glass's character calls it an origin story.
Was it because all the stuff was going to come out eventually, and the statement that there are people over the world who had this?
Maybe. So, like, that it was about the start, you know, of something. Yeah, it could have been reflected, because at that point in the film, you didn't know that he had already orchestrated that the footage of their battle and everything would be sent out, and that evidence of these, like, superhuman people would be potentially shared.
Right.
With
and
the
Sarah
world.
Paulson's character said this, we have to go and, like, continue to do what we do, because these are, people are everywhere.
Yeah.
So, and the origin story of this is, like, the start of something big. Mm-hmm. And how, if they can't keep doing what they're doing, what will happen from there?
Yeah.
Origin story.
Origin story. Hashtag origin story.
Hashtag origin story.
And so, like, I mean, there's a lot to unpack with these films, and he clearly had a lot of ideas and was influenced largely with all, I mean, superhero films and concepts is, like, such a big thing now.
Yeah.
And it, so it makes sense that it would be something that he would be trying to work with or incorporate or, you know, include in his, you know, film library or whatever. But mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting what you said about how, like, when he made Unbreakable, like, maybe he had the intention of immediately rolling into the next films of those characters, and it didn't work out, because I think it's almost like one of the biggest benefits and biggest downfalls of this trilogy, the fact that there was, like, that 15-year gap between Unbreakable and Split was like, wait, what the fuck are we doing? Like,
this, who are you again?
What are we? He's like calling back to this bullshit, like, that long ago. But at the same time, if he had made those second and third movies back immediately after Unbreakable, I don't think that they would have been successful.
Probably not, because those were before a lot of the stuff was coming out.
Exactly. I feel like what made these films great was James McAvoy. And he wouldn't necessarily have had, maybe he would have found a different performer that would have, you know, done that role justice. Who knows what he would have come up with in the early 2000s. But for me, the only thing that makes these films worth anything is James McAvoy's performance. And so if he had been making these films 15 years sooner, he wouldn't have had that.
Yeah, it would have been big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
But then again, we would have been living in ignorance, not knowing.
It's a dark thing.
I know.
Very dark.
All right. Well, interesting conversation.
Woo!
Watch these or don't. That's what I have to say in the end.
No, I would say watch all of them.
Don't.
No. At least once. Even... And I will say this 100%, even though I don't feel like Unbreakable is a good movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't think it's enjoyable. I don't think it's entertaining.
But go watch it.
But Tom knows this about me, that not only will I watch those movies, I will watch them true. More than once.
She'll watch it if it's part of a, yeah.
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 It's one of those things where I'm like, really? You can't just like look up what happened and move on with your life?
Uh-huh.
You have to devote your hours and your life to this?
Yeah. And sometimes the hours
I had to watch this terrible movie today.
Oh my God.
You didn't.
I had to watch.
No,
I had to watch it. I had to watch Leprechaun 4. I couldn't not watch
it. I didn't make you watch Leprechaun 4. I only made you watch the first one. But no, I will say that all three of these movies are absolutely worth watching at least once.
Yeah. I mean, I liked Split, too.
So. I mean, every one of them reflects something that the filmmaker was trying to accomplish that meant something. And while I don't think that Unbreakable was entertaining, I feel like it still has value and merit. He's giving me a face.
No, okay.
And then I felt like Split was incredible. I feel like that was a spectacular movie.
That's the scariest. That's what this podcast is about. So,
Split and we said you didn't have to alone. Watch both. Split could stand alone on as a fantastic, scary, not supernatural, but psychotic, scary, violent movie.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't need the whole arc of the storyline of the... Yeah, you don't need Sam Jackson. You don't need any of that stuff in that. I feel like Split could stand alone. The trilogy as a whole, I feel like it deserves a watch once. He's still looking at me.
He's like, I don't have an opinion on this.
Yeah.
Just, you know, watch these maybe over... What are your DVDs?
What?
All the DVDs
Rosh Hashanah?
That you have.
Like what?
No, all the DVDs that you have with all the different...
Yes.
Like 3, 4, 5, 6, all the bad ones.
Yeah.
Like Phantasm or whatever yeah. you have.
Well, no, and that's what... Because during COVID, when I printed out the list of the AFI Top 100 films and all the different genre categories, and I was like going through and watching all of them, and I would say to him, like, oh, God, I gotta watch this. I gotta watch this. He's like, you don't have to watch any of this.
She's like, I've preemptively decided I have to.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's like some... I mean, obviously, it's a little bit of a, like, weird OCD psychological trigger of, like, let's check all these boxes. But at the same time, like, you know, the amount of effort and work and time that went into any film... You know, that it's like, okay, well, let's give it a moment. Let's give it credit. Let's watch it at least once. No, he's still giving me the face.
I don't need to watch all the Texas Chainsaw Massacres.
Oh.
I can have you tell me about it.
Well, they're all great. They're amazing.
Okay, so moving on.
What?
For the next movies we're doing.
What are those?
We're doing Signs.
You're doing Signs.
Yep. From 2002, I just graduated high school in that.
Yeah.
That's
a beautiful thing. We had just met 2002, Tom and I.
Wow.
Tom and I got together in 2002. It was a great camping
Watching
trip.
Watching all the bad movies. And then The Happening that was released in 2008.
Which is, I love.
Which is weird.
I love that movie.
I think it's just weird,
love
but
it
we
so
can
much.
Talk about
it's
it more
not
later.
Just because Mark Wahlberg's in it.
Oh, my. Yeah, I love him. Oh, I love him. And the other guys, he's so great.
He's so good.
He's like, I'm a peacock. You gotta let me fly.
You gotta
he's like, that
fly.
Doesn't make
peacocks
sense.
Peacocks don't fly.
He's hilarious. So, thanks for tolerating?
Nope. Cheers to that.
Thank you for tolerating
all the slurring that was a part of this episode.
I think that was mostly you, except for my mispronunciation just now.
Shut up.
You just shut up.
To put?
All right. Thanks for listening. We will... bye.
<You're>